than a full-on, open, and honest dialogue about our own pastoral renaissance. What do we mean when we refer to a process of deep urban transformation as a renaissance? Who are the primary beneficiaries of pastoral renaissance? Are there people and groups being left behind? How can we ensure that all members of our communities share in Buffalo's resurgence? These are the questions that will animate the discussion today, and I'm very grateful to all of you for participating. Now I'd like to introduce Mary Jean Jacobosi.
Civic and cultural literacy. The most basic of these tools other in the room together, and then getting them to talk about things they don't normally talk about. We're in conversation business, because it is through conversation that people gain better insights into the struggles there and other communities face. To flourish, democratic society requires not only the formal mechanisms of liberal governance, but also communities with robust understanding of what civic engagement means. Most Americans assume maybe that casting a vote every couple of years counts as civic engagement, but that's obviously not the full extent of it. This lack of understanding of the dynamic nature of civic engagement has not been helped by the caustic tone of political discourse in this country in recent years, and indeed in recent days. People no longer trust each other or their society. And without a sustainable belief that society operates equitably, differences of opinion or values can lead to intractable political or cultural polarization. Across the country, within our own communities and here in Buffalo, people are losing faith in the great promises of the American democracy, of equal protection before the law, equal opportunity, and equal treatment, and settling into the cynicism that is corrosive to democracy and can lead to social polarities. So our event tonight is a hopeful one, despite what I just said. And momentum, we feel it, momentum is building toward remedying these social and economic issues. And some of them are quite within our grasp. Everyone wants remedies, quick outcomes, okay, so do we. But we feel that one of the best ways to force systemic and institutional and structural change is by informing and uniting members of disparate communities. We can't hope to solve the problems associated with segregation of Buffalo right now, but we can broaden the dialogue to include all of the types of actors who can achieve change. And even so, we think we have several paths toward action that we wanted to offer to you tonight. For one thing, after tonight's discussion, you will hopefully be better informed about the history of segregation in Buffalo and how that unfortunate history is connected to broader currents in American history. So that's one path forward, and that's called personal knowledge. For another, we'd like you to continue the conversation. The council would like to help you do that. We have a program called Community Conversations, which is, in effect, a way for any organization, be it a library, a church, a civic group, a PTA, anywhere in the state, to host their own intimate town hall-style conversation on the issues. We provide everything needed to run the conversation, including toolkits that have a brief reading. You can read it right in your group and within 90 minutes, to serve as conversation starters, tips on how to run that conversation, facilitate it, what if someone's talking too much, someone's not talking enough. So we have answers to that. And a guide with sample questions to run the conversation. We also provide a training to the facilitators, whoever's going to run that for you. And most importantly, we pay a micro grant to run it. The micro grants are $200 to organizations that run it along our lines and register for the program. So we're currently putting the finishing touches on a toolkit that's going to riff on tonight's theme and give you a chance to talk about it in communities. So please watch our website for announcements if you're signed up for this. But we could do by seeding these conversations with as few as 8 to 15 participants at a time. We think we can help people not only find their voices, but allow them to speak in a chorus and help promote change. In groups like this, you see leaders emerging from the group just by finding the courage to speak. And again, we'll pay you to have that conversation. As you probably saw in the lobby, there are several organizations here that work on these issues. The National Federation for Just Communities, Housing Opportunities Made Equal, called HOME, Voice Buffalo, and Partnership for the Public Good, and Open Buffalo, maybe outside of the town, to show you actual opportunities to volunteer and spark action. So if you do speak with them after the event and learn how you can get involved. We've also pulled together, with the help of Ann Connell and the library, a reading list. There's a huge set of titles back there in front of an exhibition. I encourage you to look at those. So you can learn more about the de facto segregation and the history of housing inequality in the United States. So these are some of the concrete steps you can take personally to keep the conversation going and hopefully make Buffalo's Renaissance contribute more to everyone's community. A bit about formats and housekeeping. We're going to open with a brief video that will set the stage for some of the comments this evening, and then the conversation will have history. Second, we'll discuss the present situation. Last, the future, and some ways to help forge solutions to persistent structural issues. So as I said, after each of those 15-minute sections, we will have an audience Q&A. We don't have a lot of time in between those, but we want to hear from a lot of you, so we ask you to keep questions down to actual questions, not so much comments, 30 seconds maybe, like that's a small ad on TV. We'll have a microphone available in front and one studio. So thank you for your time, and the next thing that we do now is watch the video.
On the white properties were approved. Between 1934 and 1962, the federal government underwrote $120 billion in new housing. Less than 2% went to non-whites.
I can understand an individual, depending on his environment or his family or whatever, being racist, but for your country to sanction it, give him tools to do that, there's something definitely wrong there.
Two handhelds that you all will share.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to this evening, which we hope will be an enlightening conversation. It's my pleasure to introduce your panel tonight, and let me tell you who I am first. My name is Francisco Vasquez. I'm President and CEO of Child and Family Services, and I will be the moderator tonight. Let me introduce the panel. Reverend James Dial, President of Back to Basics Ministries, Dr. Henry Lewis Taylor, Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Buffalo, Ms. Clotilde D. Becker, President and CEO of the Community Foundation for Greater Buffalo, and Mr. Keith Lucas, Director of Community Planning for the City of Buffalo Urban Renewal Agency. So sit back. Put your seatbelts on, and maybe you're rocking or bright tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce then the first topic, which would be about our history. Let's begin. I'm going to ask the panel to comment on what in our history may be instructive of our circumstances today, and to what extent did public policies and practices of the past help shape the disparities that disproportionately impact communities of color today.
Yeah, I'll get started. Can you hear me? Yes. These microphones are kind of funny. You can't hear yourself that well. One of the most striking things I think about Buffalo, New York, is that Buffalo was not always a segregated city. During the early decades of the 20th century, on the Lower East Side, blacks and white immigrants shared residential space. And according to much of the data that we have, there are instances in which they actually lived together inside of the same boarding houses. So highly segregated neighborhoods and communities is not part of our DNA. So what happened? How did we end up from being a place with high levels of segregation to one of the most segregated cities in the United States? I would argue that... Well, I'm going to keep going because they probably got the time clock working on me. I'm going to argue that the very way that we build our cities automatically segregates African Americans and Latins on the most underdeveloped and undesirable residential lands in the city. The built environment means that the urban structure is designed and built just as any other house. So in the early 20th century, because of the rise of the industrial society, the emergence of technological change and mass influx of population groups, the city decided that the urban structure had become obsolete and needed to be redesigned and built. They imagined building a great metropolitan city in which they fused together the city and the suburb and it would be anchored by mass home ownership and the single family home. In this paradigm, they wanted to create an urban structure in which homeowners were segregated from renters, and higher income groups, owners and renters, were segregated from lower income groups, and lower income groups would be forced to live on the most underdeveloped areas of the city, in places where they shared residential space with factories, commercial, and industrial society. The operating system in this new model, using computer terms and language, was the urban land market. The idea was to build a highly rational urban land market that would maximize profits within the residential land market. And the urban land market is like a hungry dog. It wants to eat. The land market will always flip land from low value to high value uses. Hence, there was a necessity to cluster these places together. It was not necessary for them to talk about race in the building of the structure, because they understood that racism in the labor market meant that African Americans and Latins, when they came to the city, would have the lowest incomes, and that would force them to search for housing in the most underdeveloped sections of the city. As that model emerged, the segregation processes began. One final mark before I pass this thing. We talk a lot about the federal policies that dealt with mortgage systems, the Federal Housing Administration, the Homeowners Loan Corporation. But what we need to pay closer attention to is the federal policies led by Herbert Hoover that gave cities the power to build these class stratified, race-based neighborhoods. The point that I'm making is that I'm talking about zoning laws. I'm talking about standard practices of city planning, with zoning laws being the single most important of these elements, because the zoning laws allow urban planners and municipalities to create these homeownership rental zones and the like. The way we build cities, past, present, will always segregate blacks, Latins, and low-income groups on the most underdeveloped and undesirable residential lands until we change fundamentally the way we build such places.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. And I wish Dr. Taylor would be a bit more passionate about this stuff.
Well, this is a PowerPoint, right? From your passion. But I guess as a local planner and an employee of the Rural Renewal Agency, certainly our history has been intimately involved with a lot of these issues Dr. Taylor brings up. When you talk about land values, I think obviously the whole genesis of the renewal agencies, which came in the 1950s and were a federal program, was to take land that had become very marginalized and try to flip that into land that would support high value redevelopment. And so if you look at the city of Buffalo and the early urban renewal plans, they were pretty much all scattered around downtown and waterfront. And again, I think in a way to recapture value that had been lost in those neighborhoods to move the folks who had been living there, who were largely poor and minority, into new housing so that they could use those areas to support downtown growth, to support access and egress into downtown from the suburbs. So I think building on those initial policies in the 30s with redlining and things like that, the next step was more of the urban renewal period, when they started looking at these neighborhoods, waterfront neighborhoods that never had much value because they were there for industry and transportation, started to see the value in these areas as well, and then needed a way to move the poorer people who were living there out of these neighborhoods so they could be recapitalized.
Thank you.
So I'll comment on the importance of this particular section of the conversation, because in order to understand how to move forward more productively and build the future of the community that we deserve, and that more importantly our children deserve, we need to understand how we got here, understand the history and the forces that shaped our current reality, the forces that maintain the current realities, and put them squarely on the table so that we have a well-defined, well-informed understanding of what it is in order to be able to change what it is. And I think what we're hearing here from my colleagues on the panel is that there's a tremendous history of institutional and structural racism that has been played out in our community, and understanding the forces of policy decisions that have led to our current circumstances is an important position for our community to be in. And my observation has been that these forces are poorly understood. As the foundation has been working on this for 10 to 11 years, if you did a person on the street interview right outside this library at noon on any given day in Buffalo, and you asked somebody to explain what they ever wondered or redlining to what it is, I don't think you get a lot of responses to that. We have been denied our history, and understanding the forces that have led to our current realities so that we can, with intentionality, undo those forces so that we can move forward without repeating the mistakes of the past.
Reverend Giles.
As Dr. Taylor pointed out, this whole redlining and rebuilding communities is really an economic-based piece. Matter of fact, this country was founded on that very principle. Even the framers of the Constitution was really about economics, that the U.S. or European Americans somehow think that they have this global manifest destiny piece at work, that they structure things and build things solely to benefit the few. And those individuals that lack funds and individuals that were coming out of slavery had no money. They had nothing. They didn't get 40 acres and a mule like was promised. So they had to struggle. And so they operated at a stratus well below poverty, well below means to actually compete with anyone trying to find a fine home. So as a consequence, we have created all of these neighborhoods based upon the same principles that this very fine country was built upon, that if you have money, then you can attain certain levels. Well, this is why you have this problem in urban communities, because so many poor African Americans in particular, but people of color, because they are poor, they have been congregated into these underdeveloped homes where other people, and now you have these landlords that leave such homes because they know, and solely for money's sake, again, it's about money, solely for money's sake, because the home fails to generate money, then they leave the homes to dilapidate, and now they expect them to be occupied by African-American people that's looking for homes. So it has put the city of Buffalo, in particular, at odds with each other, at odds, because as this system was developing, there was individuals that were benefiting from such structure that actually said nothing, and I see that happening today. Because those that benefit from such system, if they don't say anything about it, then the status quo is going to continue. The only way we're going to begin to really eradicate these systems that are intentionally against marginalized groups, the only is when those that benefit from the system begin to speak up.
I just want to make one final statement before we open it up for questioning. Back in the early 20s, they had a choice. They could have built a just city, or they could build this class stratified metropolitan area with a racially segregated underpinning. The point I want to make, it was a choice. They didn't have to build this. They could have built something else.
Thank you, Dr. Don Taylor. I think we can open up for questions now.
Real quick, Dr. Taylor, you just mentioned Just Cities. They could have built Just Cities. Can you elaborate on what Just Cities mean?
What I'm saying is that it was possible, number one, to design and build neighborhoods in which the various classes of the population lived in the same neighborhood and community together. A second aspect of that, they could have continued to marginally commodify the residential environment. Throughout most of the nation's history until 1930, racism never covered the living place. Blacks and whites often shared residential spaces together. And that didn't mean it was kumbaya time. I mean, racism was there and racism was alive. And one of the reasons that racism was so intense was a way to keep the social classes separated. But even down on the Lower East Side, we have evidence to show that there were blacks who learned German so they could hang out with the Germans. We have evidence to show that there may have been hatred by day, but there was some kumbaya across the racial line by night. The point I'm making is that all of these groups, they lived in these shared spaces and they had common interests. So it was possible to build a community anchored around social housing rather than private housing as a dominant form. And in many parts of Europe and other countries, this is the part of the process that they did. So the desire to build a residential environment anchored by the owner-occupied house, in which you transform neighborhoods into sites of consumption and wealth production, did not have to occur. We could have built very different types of neighborhoods. And again, I want to go back to this question. We think of the city as if it's some weed that just grows. But cities are designed. They're designed, just as this library was designed. And people who design the city create the spaces that they desire. Underdeveloped neighborhoods, and I call them underdeveloped because they're not distressed, they're not disadvantaged, they're not low income, they're not poor, they are underdeveloped. And the way we build cities, develop communities, must, out of necessity, underdevelop other communities. That's why the way we build cities have to be changed. So I say Buffalo is rising, but the Buffalo is stampeding ordinary people, and it's rising by running over their backs.
In terms of the history of Buffalo, I'm wondering if anyone can comment on the history of struggle against these processes, of the individuals, the groups, the movements who have contested these, and the lessons that they have for us today.
Great question.
Wherever there is oppression, there will always be resistance. Those two things go hand in hand. And so throughout the history of Black Buffalo, there has always been movements designed to fight for the liberation and freedom of African-American people. The Niagara movement itself that led to the formation of the NAACP, occurred here in Buffalo. And so throughout that, at every stage in the history of the city, there's been a movement that has evolved to fight against it. Sometimes those movements have been well known. At other times, those movements have had an underground element. For example, back in the 1970s, where there was Build Organization and others, the city of Buffalo also had one of the most vibrant Black Worker Congress chapters anywhere in the country. And the Black Workers Congress was a national left organization led by James Forman. And many of the members of that organization that operated underground in that movement would now appear to be a who's who in the city of Buffalo. I will not name them, at least you won't see me tomorrow. But, but I will say that I was one of those underground members, and that's how I know about a lot of the things that were going on. The principle is, wherever there is oppression, it breeds resistance and the fight for change. And that's what we're seeing now in places like Ferguson and Baltimore and Charlotte and Baton Rouge and in other places around the country, Dallas, etc. So it's a rich history of that, and it will continue.
Reverend Johns?
Yeah, just a word about the movement. And there has been in the city of Buffalo and as well as around the nation plenty of movement. However, those movements, because of lack of complete unity in the groups that are impacted mostly by such injustice, because of the lack of having them all come together, we have failed to make a collective impact, which means that if anything that's going to be significant in terms of moving the system a step away from where it currently is required the collective body, meaning those that have benefited again and those that are not benefited, those that are being denied, coming together in a massive way, in a continuing and persistent way to cause collective impact. And that's what's going to require for the change.
Another question?
Dr. Taylor, I watch you on Facebook and I know you're well traveled. I have a question for you. One of the things that Council President Pridgen has put forth for the city is inclusionary zoning. I think it's something that the council has voted on. What do you think that this is something that could be very helpful? Because I know you talked earlier about zoning, how zoning has created some of the problems that we have. Do you think that would be a huge step forward to change the dynamics?
It will be a step forward, but it will not be a huge step forward, because the inclusionary zoning does not touch the operation of the urban land market. I'm not going to speak much on that now because we'll have a whole section that relates that. A big step forward would be the development of a very aggressive community land trust program that begins to put large segments of land in the control of the people.
Just a comment to build on Dr. Taylor's response around the land trust and how to achieve some of these solutions, which will be the next part of the dialogue, and Reverend Giles' comment about what it's going to take, and I couldn't agree more, that it does take unprecedented coalitions to move agendas with a tremendous amount of focus and strategy and discipline. These issues are incredibly emotional. All you have to do is turn on your TV or whatever your social media device, and you pretty much have to be made out of stone not to react emotionally to what's happening across our nation and within our own community. But to the degree that we can exercise the discipline to build coalitions across the sectors and across the chasms in our own community, we can begin to move focused agendas with strategy and intentionality. And I do believe we have a window and a moment in time in our community right now where that is the call before us.
Before we move on, I just want to reemphasize that. We're in a moment now where the collaboration will be the organization of the 21st century. And the problems that we face are extraordinarily complex and difficult. So we will have to be highly disciplined. We will have to be extremely well organized And we will have to learn that there's a role and a place for everyone. And if we're able to do that, then I think that we can begin to dismantle the structures of racism and social class inequality that plague us today.
Another question?
Yes. As a retired teacher, I am interested in how, and I am directing this question to Dr. Taylor, how do you see the struggle for quality education in the city in light of what we have discussed so far?
Right now we have a window of opportunity. It's a small window, but it's a window of opportunity that we have not had before. And it will take a lot of creativity, a lot of hard work, and a lot of discipline and determination to make that happen. The Buffalo Public Schools have put together 13 community schools. But they have organized these 13 community schools into a series of four zones, community school zones. One on the east west side, one in northern part of the east side, one called the east side in the center of the east side, and then in the South Buffalo area. The community school framework, if properly utilized, allows us to build interactive linkages and connection between school reform and the transformation of the neighborhoods in which these schools are embedded. And I firmly believe that the only way that we can improve the quality of education is by transforming the neighborhoods and the communities in which our children live. The critical part of the community school model is that it will have community leadership groups overseeing the operation of each of the zones, or the activities within each of the zones, which gives us an unprecedented opportunity for people in the neighborhoods and communities to work with the teachers and the principals and folks that live in the neighborhoods in order to bring about that change. It's a window, and it will take a lot of work to make that come true, but we're closer to having the kind of positive impact from a programmatic point of view than I think we've been in a very long time.
And I think in the area of education, to build on Dr. Taylor's comments, we are in the midst of an unprecedented collective effort, Say Yes Buffalo Partnership, where we are getting early and real tangible results. So the post-secondary matriculation rate, something beyond high school, whether it's a certificate, an associate's, or a bachelor, which is what you need to earn a living wage in this community. The rates of post-secondary matriculation in the city of Buffalo have gone up 10 percentage points in just 3 years. We are at 67%. The national average is 61% for all school districts, urban, rural, and suburban. We are actually beating the national average for all school districts in the city of Buffalo. If you look at the national average for post-secondary matriculation rates for urban school districts, it's 53%, which is pathetic. But the city of Buffalo is now on the rise with a 61% matriculation rate, which will continue to rise. And the reason why this is working is because we have what you've heard my colleagues on the panel describe, an unprecedented coalition of private sector, public sector, neighborhood leaders, parents, union leaders, higher education, business leaders, everyone in the community is around the table pulling in the same direction, and that is based on the belief that every child has the potential to succeed. And we are doing things we've never done in ways we've never done them in this community to ensure that we remove the barriers, that we address the different needs of differently situated students in our school district, and that we ensure that all of our students reach their potential. The numbers are moving in the right direction. We are getting it done. And the nation is watching Buffalo as we achieve what cities around the country are hoping to achieve themselves.
Thank you. We will now pivot from the past to the present. The legacy of segregation continues to burden our community. It is inarguable that our community is divided by race. How do institutions, that is, our governmental agencies, healthcare and education systems, our financial systems and media, and how does place, that is, where people live, where they work, where they play, contribute to our unfulfilled potential?
Well, I would say that it's not so much the legacy of segregation that is creating havoc in our lives. It is the legacy of the land market that is creating havoc in our lives. My center, we've taken a look at all of the clusters where African American and Latins, and I use Latins for Latinos and Latinas, so rather than saying Latino and Latina, I just say Latins, because most of you know Spanish is a very gender-oriented language. But let's take as a quintessential example of what's going on in Buffalo, is the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus. And I have two things to say about that place. One is that the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus professes to be and probably is one of the quintessential world health centers around. The building and the development of that campus destroyed the African-American community. In 1970, there were 9,000 black folks living in the Fruit Belt community. Today, some 36 years later, there are only about 1,700 that are living there. From Best Street all the way over, that used to be margin, used to be filled with all kinds of housing units. The city of Buffalo, they had a choice. They did not have to build it that way. I know they had a choice because in 2000, I led a team that put together a comprehensive plan for the redevelopment of the Fruit Belt and outline a strategy for developing, but they did not. So the expansion of that campus has destroyed that community. Then if we look at all of the other nodals in Buffalo where opportunities are emerging, people of color are being pushed outside of those communities. Now one might say, well, the campus, it's delivering health services. Really? As I speak, in the 62 counties in New York City, Buffalo ranks around 54 in terms of the quality of health. We are one of the unhealthiest counties in New York State. So the payoff has not been a payoff that has impacted the African American community and the Latin community, both in terms of neighborhoods or in terms of jobs and other types of opportunities. So again, the way we are building Buffalo today, this rising Buffalo, is underdeveloping and creating chaos in the lives of the African American community. And until we can control the way in which this land market operates on the one hand, and the way in which racism in the labor market operates on the other hand, the potential victories that we're winning on the educational front will get canceled out because people will not be able to get houses and will not live, jobs and will not be able to live in stable communities.
Reverend Giles?
To the point that the ideal notion that racism is still occurs, I'm more concerned with some of the social impacts that this type of redlining and this type of zoning, this type of planning for the community has on the people. I have young kids that look out the window from depressed neighborhoods and see a whole construction crew, and nobody looks like them, all right? And because nobody looks like them, and then when their families are having a hard time eating and a hard time paying bills, and they wonder why my young kids are walking around here angry at the world, and they know, listen, they know The only target they have is themselves. It's creating all of this type of segregating events that's taking place in the communities. Now we're gaining some traction in terms of this collective and collaborative effort that the community, because everyone is being concerned now. But it's not just us concerned. I have individuals that from across the tracks that are concerned. Suburban and urban communities are concerned. And it's going to require this type of collective effort to begin to change the way people feel about racism and about what's going on.
Keith worked for the city hall, so he don't want to say too much. But he told me before the program started, we got to stop this.
Let me ask a follow-up question then. Do you see evidence of new redlining?
Redlining is a tricky term, and I want to say that in the sense that the location where many African Americans and Latins live, based on the housing market and the way that's structured, those houses do not generate wealth. They generate debt, but not wealth. So in studies that we've done in housing value across the city of Buffalo, housing values on the east side and housing values in certain Latin neighborhoods are pretty stagnant, and that's across the board. Then, because of the racism in the markets, when African Americans and Latins, and I suspect low-income whites, get loans, they are ending up with these subprime loans, all kind of poor mortgage packages. Therefore, when the downturns occurred, like the 2008 crisis, two things happened. Many blacks lost their homes through foreclosure, but thousands more, their mortgages went underwater. And what an underwater mortgage means is you now owe more than what the house is worth. So you can't sell the house because it's not worth as much as you owe. And the only way that you can get out of that bind is by making a deal with the bank where they do a short buy and you walk away with a loss. So we're caught in these situations, and a part of that is that African American and Latin neighborhoods differ from many of the suburban neighborhoods in this way. In many of the Latin and black neighborhoods, you have homeowners with large numbers of low-income renters occupying the space. And as a consequence of that, that lowers the value. So in the United States, the so-called American dream thing notwithstanding, in the African American community, for most blacks, as well as in the Latin community, home ownership is not an instrument of wealth production.
But with that hope, there's a lot of uncertainty in the communities because of justification. How are we going to ensure that justification does not break up the communities that this city is built on?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, and we'll talk about this when we get in the other section. I think number one is that we have to develop community land trust that's going to take control of large segments of land. We've got to develop community benefit agreements that will keep developers from seizing control over certain areas. And we've got to put a lot of pressure on our legislators. Or ask them to change their names from legislators to something else. because they aren't producing legislation that's designed to protect and serve us. But we've got to create laws that will stabilize certain of these areas so that people don't get kicked out. I mean, there's no reason, for example, what is it, the South Shore?
The Lakeshore
Apartments. Why do we have to give that up? We have to find ways to protect that. Or why are we in a situation where we allow certain parts, certain forms of housing to deteriorate because we know they're being developed? I'm talking about in and around down in Perry Street and these other areas that's really hot. We have to have systems in place to preserve that. I don't call it gentrification. I call it black and brown lives don't mattification. And that's what we got to stop.
To the point that it is going to require some stringent legislation to begin to change the policies where developers come into neighborhoods and take over. Now, they only do that in these urban communities that have no power. They don't do that in other communities. They're not going to come out in Amherst and do that and just say, I want to build this. But the community is going to come out in full force and say, you're not going to have that. For my sake, I'm tired of sitting on panels having to discuss a community benefits agreement with a developer that wants to come in and do what they want to do and not do diversity for the labor force and not do diversity and not do what's well and what's right for that community. I'm tired of having those agreements. It ought to be in the legislation. They do it for the environment, then they could do it for our neighborhood.
Again, some of these things we'll focus on when we get into the solution part of the conversation. But I want to say that in black and Latin communities, one of the great challenges that we face is that we're building communities on land that someone else owns and controls. And so we have to create the mechanisms that will make that possible. One of the big tools is to create, through legislation, and I'm sure there's some legislators in here listening to me, to create community councils, neighborhood councils, that begin to empower people to make choices and decisions over the developments that occur inside of their neighborhoods. And going back to what Pastor Giles says, we must organize these neighborhoods and communities and then build linkages betwixt and between these neighborhoods and unities. Rather than fussing about the east side and the west side and the south side, my thing is that neighborhoods in all sides should unite because there's more of us than it is of them. I don't know of any cities in the United States like that because they all use the same operating system. But I have spent quite a bit of time in Cuba, and I know that because they alter the way in which the land market operates, they were able to achieve a level of diversity in terms of neighborhoods by race, class, etc. But now, as they begin to reinstate market activities, you can already begin to see how the market begins to operate. It spits people out. So show me a place where the urban land market is functioning as it functions, and I'll show you a place that's segregated. It'll either be doing it by race, it will be doing it by class, but it will segregate. Because just like a hungry dog eats, the land market flips value from low to high. And it will always do that. It's sort of like chickens lay eggs. No matter what you do, a chicken will not lay a brick. It will only lay eggs because that is its nature. So the land market will always flip from low to high. You will find no land market trying to flip from high to medium to low because that's not what it does. So we have to bring the land market under control, which means it, in some instances you will commodify certain parts of it. In other instances, you will want it to flourish. So it's not to eliminate the land market. The land market has a power that it can display. But you have to regulate it. You have to control it. And my last point on that, we must, in places like Buffalo, link economic development to social development. In this city, we create a separation between economic development and social development so that economic development becomes an end within itself. When economic development is linked to social development, we then begin to create opportunities to grow the economy so that we can develop society. So it means that if we know we're going to engage in massive building activities in Buffalo, we immediately begin to train and develop the young people so that they can take advantages of those jobs and opportunities. Link economic development to social development. That is one of our main tasks.
Yes, and to add that to that, so no, there are no cities in America that have this figured out yet, and Dr. Taylor actually points out to the market forces outside of our country that demonstrate the challenge. But intentionality, I think, lies at the heart of all this in the planning and the public decision-making that actually shapes and builds the physical environment. And linking the human development to economic development is absolutely critical, and it's remarkably a new concept.
Yeah.
Because it's all about our human capital, and it's all about our potential future, current and future workforce. So yes, it's a challenge everywhere, but we have a particularly significant challenge in our community, because we have something called a 90% isolation index. It's 88%, 70%, so whatever, rounding up. So a 90% isolation index in this community, which is a very, very high isolation index as it compares to many other communities. And what that means is that there is a 90% probability that a white person in our region will not have a meaningful exchange with a person of color on any given day. So how does that bode for, when you put it against facts such as the number of students of color in the K-12 system in our region? It's 33%, folks. 33% of the students in our K-12 system throughout the region, not just Buffalo, it's much higher, it's close to 80% Buffalo, are students of color. And what does it mean for the white kids in this community, in when you look to the future, as we are part of a regional economy, as we are part of a national economy, where the majority will be people of color by the year 2040, and as we are all part, whether we like it or not, of a global economy, we are ill preparing all of our kids, but particularly our white kids, to function in a diverse, multicultural future, which is not a prediction, it is a reality. So we as a region are particularly challenged around creating more integration. And when I look out on this audience, this is not the audience you normally see in our community. Look around, folks. Is this what you normally see every day in our community? We need to build more audiences like this and create the spaces for people to come together as people and debunk this myth of human hierarchy.
Highways were raised to urban neighborhoods, and I don't think it's a coincidence
said, they affected a lot of black neighborhoods. Like in Buffalo, Hamlin Park was becoming predominantly black at the time that Humboldt Parkway was removed in favor of Pennington Expressway. It was part of a misguided plan that other cities are just now, are either just now fixing or have long since fixed, but it seems like Buffalo can't seem to keep up with the rest of the nation. And I think that there's three main problems behind that. The first problem is that the highway is supervised by the Department of Transportation, and regardless of the devastating effects it's had in our neighborhoods, they seem set in their ways. Another problem is that the people in the city who have experienced the destruction of Humboldt Parkway, they're discouraged and they don't want to do what it takes to see the change anymore. And the third problem is that I represent a group that wants to see the change, but we're not seeing enough solidarity among our city leaders. That includes the mayor and the entire common council. So what I'm trying to say is, do you think that with a project such as remediating even a portion of Humboldt Parkway, we would begin to see more results on the state level if we saw more solidarity among our city leaders?
I think generally most elected officials would support something like that happening, but I think it all comes back to some cost, which is the problem that the federal government's going to say, well, you know, the cost for removing the Humboldt Expressway to 33198 is just so astronomical. You know, the money better spent on other investments. I think that's pretty much the argument that you get. So as a community, we say we want to spend $1.5 billion on this, or we want to put that investment somewhere else. It's a difficult question, and again, if it's very expensive to correct these mistakes that we made in the past, would we do it that way today? I don't think so. But I'm just not sure that there is the money available to actually do something to correct that in any meaningful way right now. Obviously, the state puts money to study it, and we'll get a better sense once that study's completed, but it's going to be a huge lift to try and remove that that infrastructure at the current time.
It's not as simple as talking about the lots. We have to ask for the we have to ask for the support of other communities. But how do we also manage to deal with this issue of this destruction that's coming in from the medical corridor? And we know that it's going to be a continual problem, but we can't get anything in the way of help with that, right?
I feel strongly about the things that you've said, because a lot of those challenges with all of the different levels and magnitudes of impact were there. And I think it's, I think our legislators have let the people down. I mean, there was recently an article that was talking about the dramatic drop in the poverty rate in the Fruit Belt. And as I told the folks, well, what do you expect when you push all of the people out? But one of our local politicians, instead of using that moment to denounce the kind of development, went on to talk about the Fruit Belt is rediscovering community, which is putting a smiley face on an awful situation. So a number of the things that could occur are legislative types of things that we should fight for. But again, I think going back to something that has been said on several different occasions, the only way we win these struggles is when we begin to build unity across the different neighborhoods and groups, and counteract the kind of public relations propaganda that comes from the medical campus that continues to minimize the way that it has destroyed that community in terms of what it once was. I always use the Fruit Belt as an example, but what we are seeing there in varying degrees is occurring everywhere. I mean, we've watched, if you pay a close attention to what's going on in the far west side, where property values are beginning to rise and push out those folks, how the downtown corridors are shifting, and increasingly African Americans are being pushed farther and farther to the borders of the suburbs. And in places like St. Louis, you have more blacks living in the suburbs than in the central city. In places like Cleveland, they're being pushed out as whites leave northern suburbs and moving into the south. So it's a huge problem, but it is not a problem that can be just won by the Fruit Belt. Folks across the city will have to unite if we have a chance of winning it.
So now we talk about the future. I know there are a lot of questions, folks, but we need to get on to the next section. We all understand that there's an attraction to investing in our city. We call it a renaissance. We have a sense of better days, perhaps. While this may be cause for celebration, not everyone is welcome to the party. This regeneration is a hopeful concept, but it has unintended consequences. Please speak to the effects and tell us what you think must be done to mitigate the impact as we go forward.
I'll jump out. To me, I think one of the first and most important things that we need to do is to put in place mechanisms. When I say the first, I mean a lot of these things have to occur concurrently. But we really have to stabilize our neighborhoods and communities. There's an enormous amount of mobility inside of the community. People are being displaced, large numbers of evictions. Then because of the high rents and low quality of housing, people move around. So without creating the mechanisms that allow us to stabilize neighborhoods and communities, we won't be able to create the organization and structure to fight back. So we've talked about land trust as one of those things. There's another huge issue, I think, that flies under the radar screen, but not really. The quality of housing in which low-income people live in, low-income groups, is despicable. It's just despicable. And not only that, but in many families on the east side and the Latino community, they're paying anywhere from 40 to 60% of their income on housing. So if you're making about $1,400 a month and you pay rent, lots of folks are left with $600 to cover everything else. And that leads to all kinds of depression, all kinds of other issues and questions. So the only way that we're going to be able to put something like that to rest, there are three things that have to be done. One is that we need legislation that will raise the quality of housing with real serious enforcement measures that are attached to it. Secondly, we have to do something that will link how much you pay to rent based on a percentage of your income. In some places around the world, they'll cap it at 20%. Or 25%. So we've got to raise the quality of housing and drop the cost of it, which means that somewhere we have to be able to generate the resources to cover the gaps. And I have some ideas about that, but I'll let some other people talk about it. Two other quick things. We've got to grow employment. And I mean, I think the city ought to create a group to find innovative ways to generate jobs and opportunities. Because this economy will not employ the masses of folks. It won't do it. So we gotta think about innovative ways of self-employment. We gotta think about ways to generate jobs through rebuilding of neighborhoods and communities. And one of my friends will kill me if I don't mention the fact we also have to find ways to support small black and Latin businesses so that they can grow and produce these income.
So yeah, safe and affordable housing, look at the issues like asthma, lead poisoning in this community. It just should simply be outlawed. These things are 100% preventable, and shame on us for not stepping up to put a stop to those things that are absolutely preventable and that undermine the future of our children. Jobs, we need a more inclusive workforce pipeline. We do need innovation. 165,000 jobs will be opening up in this community in the next 10 years. And love our region as we do, we are not going to import 165,000 people. We have to grow our own. And when there's a will, there's a way as we work across sectors to innovate. And there are communities that recently we brought in Upskill Houston, who this is an effort that has actually succeeded in addressing a more inclusive workforce pipeline. And then education, because in order to move out of poverty, and there is a high correlation of race and poverty, not only in our community but in our nation, we need folks that have the education and the training to fill those 165,000 jobs. And we need to grow our own in order to succeed. The resurgence will come to a screeching halt if we don't engage this next phase of the work. We have to ensure that every pair of hands in this community has the opportunity to do good and meaningful work at family-sustaining wages.
Well, I think as much as anybody here, we're certainly interested in figuring out ways to revitalize neighborhoods in the city. I think the main issue we've come across is the lack of funding to support those things. I was looking at some numbers for the main federal programs that the city receives through community development, block grants, and home funding. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, we were getting the equivalent of $60 to $70 million a year, whereas today we're getting about $50 million. And it's just, it makes it hard to really have the impact that you'd like. We ran the numbers for the past 10 years with the CDBG and home, and 77% of the dollars went into the east side. This is for loans to help people with home improvements, this is the home projects that construct and create new housing. It's really been focused in east side neighborhoods, but still it hasn't had the impact that we'd like to see in spinning that up. So I think a lot of that is we have to look harder at how we can build on these investments and help create better senses of community and neighborhood in these areas. But we've also
also got to be aware that this is still a capitalist nation, a capitalist system, and we've got to be able to pull in private investment. We've got to make residents feel like it's a good investment to purchase a home in these neighborhoods and to invest in it and to make a commitment to that neighborhood. I think that's largely what you see when people talk about what's happening on the west side and the changes there. It hasn't been city money, federal money, state money. It's largely the private money that individuals have said, I feel comfortable investing in this neighborhood. I feel like I'll get my money's worth out of it. That just hasn't happened on the east side for a number of reasons. But I think that's the real issue that we're facing is how can we take the money that we do have available, limited money that we have available, and make sure that it has the biggest bang for the buck in these neighborhoods.
Reverend Giles.
Yeah, money is always the key. However, everything that the system wants to do and wants to build, they find the money for. But it seems that we are not investing in humanity. We're not investing in the well-being of the least of our communities. We're not willing to set up systems where to invite individuals from investing on our city street. I take Jefferson. Jefferson should be as prosperous as Ellenwood.
That's right.
And the reason is not we're not getting the support to encourage individuals to invest. And then when monies are available to kind of fix up some of the properties, that money is not coming down there like it comes down Myrtle to fix up properties. So when we begin to think about communities and say, well, let us invest in the communities, and just maybe, I may be crazy, just maybe it would be attractive enough for others to be willing to be entrepreneurs in that area, and we need to encourage that.
Yeah. Dr. Taylor, I'm going to ask you to comment on that, but I want to hear, I've heard Dr. Taylor talk about the latte class.
Yeah, so the two things I want to say in relationship to that. The first thing I want to say is that we are making investments to spur developments, but the kind of investments and the kind of developments we are generating, they're building what I call the latte city. And by the latte city and building the latte city, I'm saying pick 10 spots, your 10 places that you would go to show Buffalo Rising. Any 10. I'm willing to bet Keith's salary that if you go to those locations and places, about 90% of the people there will be white, members of the latte class. Now, I'm simply saying that we make all kinds of investments, like a lot of these low-income tax credits. They're being used by the developers to build houses, and then they provide the low-income people with what I call the upwardly mobile pool, medical students, college students, and others. Now, back to the critical question of where the money is going to come from. This is my proposal. And I think one of our legislators in here, and this is Pick on the Legislators Day, should push to bring this into action. Why not start an East Side Regeneration Foundation with the money coming from the private sector, including our sports teams? All of these businesses, they have these social benefit foundations. They have them. We got the Wilson Foundation, all of these things. But they spend on whatever their favorite project is. Why don't they spend a proportion on that? Why not set with all of the employees? Because they always buy stuff. Everything in this room was bought. Why not say that we want 10% of everything that you buy to go to black and Latin entrepreneurs, and that if they don't have the capacity to provide the services, we will go to UB and others and match those owners with the kind of managerial help and a system to allow them to do that. We have the money inside of the region. It's just that it's not strategically spent in a way that will benefit our folks. And when it is spent, we do not link it to employment opportunities. So if we take these resources and use them to hire local folks in the neighborhoods and the communities, then we can allow the residents to rebuild their lives as they rebuild the communities in which they live.
You certainly, Dr. Taylor, present a pretty grim picture of Buffalo. And I'm reminded a little bit of the man with the terminal disease saying he's going to move to Buffalo. And when asked why, he said, because everything happens 10 years later in Buffalo. But my question has to do, in my work, I look for models.
You work for who?
I look for models, successful models, wherever they are. And I've lived in several other cities. And I've been places, I lived in Philadelphia, for example. In the 60s, there was a movement in Philadelphia to create a great neighborhood. There must be places across this country where at least there are pockets of innovation of the kind that you're talking about, where entrepreneurs, enlightened entrepreneurs, are creating housing that is integrated and that is mixed use and that is available to people of low income. I don't know where those places are, but if there are models in other parts of the country, why can't we draw on those as examples to build from ourselves?
Well, two things. The first thing, I take exception with your idea that I'm painting a grim picture. What I'm saying is that if a person is sick but has a curable disease, and you say, you're sick, we can fix you, that's not grim. That's optimistic and hopeful. What is grim is for people to say Buffalo is rising and ignoring the problems and difficulties that we face. That's the grim reaper. My message is not a message of despair. My message is a message of hope that says, one, I think we understand some of these issues and problems. Number two, I think we can figure out how to fix them. We only have to unite and find the way. Yes, there are examples in a number of places in terms of small base projects. We have examples in my office. And one of the reasons that I know about the treachery in this city is that for the last 25 years, we have given them alternative patterns of development. But what they try to do is make us think we have two choices. One choice is to allow the conditions to exist as they are, or the other choice is to build the neoliberal city and empower the latte class. I say there is a third way.
I agree with you.
And there are examples that we can find in relationship to that. So there are a number of things that we know how to do. So we do that. We're not searching for answers.
Opportunity because Buffalo is rising.
I agree with you 100%. We're on the same page in relationship to that.
Hey, Michael, there's a lady right in the center that's had her arm up for the whole club.
I'm just wondering if anyone in the panel with the strong communitarian emphasis that you have
would care to comment on this as a possible moment for relative local control of things like energy production, food, and clean water.
I think to the degree that we can continue to build and nurture a local agency at the neighborhood level, we're going to have better, more sustainable solutions. So regardless of the issue, to the degree that the local agency can be respected and engaged, we will move forward with greater urgency and greater effectiveness.
I'm certainly a proponent of those forms and those kinds of economic development. And I think one of the strategies that we can continue to do in terms of building the local economy, although it's tricky, is to learn how to engage in more local development where we create what they call economic multipliers by generating businesses that do business with each other as a way of circulating the dollars inside of the region a lot more. Because from some of the work we've done, there's still a lot of dollars that escape because we're not strategically spending and strategically building the types of businesses that we need to do. So I'm all in favor of that, but I agree that we've got to continue to grow, build, and develop the economy along with these other things. We just got to do it in a wiser and more thoughtful way, and that's what I'm talking about in terms of the third way.
And one of the points Clotilde is making is that we have to begin to find jobs for these depressed communities because that's where real economic power comes from. Because what happens is so much, even when things are built here, the money doesn't stay here. It doesn't generate money for that, even when they build houses, right? The money that people pay rent does not stay in the community. We have to begin to become more strategic about how to develop projects that are going to benefit that community, and the money is going to recycle in that community until that community has economic power. And that's where they can then begin to invest in their own communities, but only when they have opportunities to make enough money to invest.
Yeah. I just want to say one real quick thing, and that is Clotilde continues to say something that is hugely important significance, and that is intentionality. We have to do this thing in a highly conscious and intentional way.
Absolutely.
Okay, you talked about segregation early on, and what about the leaders? Because early on, we had the leaders made up a certain description of who they were. But now our leaders are more diverse, and we're still in the same situation. So what are we to do when we elect these leaders and nothing happens?
But I always say, black faces in high places don't mean a thing if they're not tied to the engines of change. So we're in a moment of time where we have to elect leaders based upon what they believe and based upon the platforms that they stand on. And again, I think as long as we rely on other people to pick our leaders and parade us, will always be in this situation. I think we have to take a much bolder, especially at a local level, where we can do that. We can come together and find people who are interested in political careers, interested in this kind of thing, but to run on the platforms that are developed by folks. But I think we get there when we build the kind of collaboration and collaboration across organizations and groups and across neighborhoods. And I think that that should become one of our electoral strategies as we look forward to moving forward, because so much of what we need to get done requires legal work and things that can only occur at the level of government. So we cannot ignore government, but we got to find the leaders that will do the things that are in the interest of our communities.
We're getting close out of time. There were a handful of high school students that were here, and I haven't seen them raise their hands, but if any of the high school students have any questions,
in front of you.
We have enormous quality within our Black and Latino neighborhoods, but not within our schools. And if we are not graduating these babies so that they can read at 3, 4, 5, design, become engineers, my community is not going to succeed. I understand and appreciate everything I've heard, but I'm concerned about my community and the children in my schools. And a young man who had an opportunity to play at some of the best colleges in the country, but his choice was to follow, I want to call him his friends, into an area that now he will be in jail for 18 years. And I need you people to understand that my community is my community. My granddaughter will be 3 in 3 weeks. She reads a little bit. She knows all of her numbers. They're at least 20. Her colors, her shapes. Her niece is going to teach her a little Chinese. But I want to know why my community is not thriving. There is no reason. There is no reason for 74 to be in receivership, for Bennett to be in receivership. The brightest and best children are ignored. There is no school on the east side that should be without books. Everyone should have a book. My granddaughter probably has more books in her little library than School 74 has for their first graders. And I need someone to answer that. I love school. And I understand that there's a method behind all that we're doing and all that we're saying here, but I need to know that my neighbors and my children and my neighborhood is going to grow. That there should be a City Honors in Hamlin Park that is filled with children of color. Not just the one that sits on the hill across from the Honor.
Well, this goes back to another one of Clotilde's favorite words, intentionality. So there's been so much disinvestment in public education, especially in the city of Buffalo, that it can only fail for one thing. So there are many dynamics that have contributed to this bad educational record we have, an academic record we have, including disfragmented families and the criminal justice system, the prison industrial complex, just the lack of workforce opportunities for our mothers and fathers of those children that go to school. So there are many dynamics that are contributing to this, and the legislators and those individual officials, and we have some good ones, right, but they can't do it alone. It's going to require a grassroots mobilization behind those legislators to push this so that we can get change. People respect organized money and organized people. Systems do, right? And so it's only when we collectively come together, and I can't emphasize this enough, we collectively come together behind these very important issues that we can effectuate change.
I think And I could not agree with you more. The secret is twofold. I mean, one is that we have to understand that black people have been trying to get an education ever since the first boat landed. And when I talk about underdevelopment, I'm saying that you cannot subjugate a people without underdeveloping them. So it will be a battle for the educational front. But I think that part of the secret is that we need to develop comprehensive plans for these neighborhoods so that we can intentionally develop them. And we've got to understand that we don't want to start the battle on the educational front at K. We have to have programs in the home, highly developed early childhood programs. So from the time that kid is born until the time that kid finishes high school, we have them in a programmatic framework. Going back to the point that the young man back there made, sitting in front of Felicia, we know how to do that. We know how to do that in Buffalo. And we have the programs in place. We just don't have the resources to implement them on a wide-based scale. So I say that the battle of the 21st century will be the battle to develop and regenerate our underdeveloped neighborhoods. So we have to cast away our illusions and realize that it will take a struggle, a fight, to create the kind of just society that we want. And we have to do it intentionally, we have to do it consciously, and we have to do it in a highly disciplined, organized, and collaborative way.
And so we begin tonight. We thank you very much for your participation, and we thank our panel for their wise wisdom. And thank you very much.